today on Against the Grain. The yellow vests have shaken the French political establishment to its core. What are the protesters' grievances and goals, and how has the uprising been viewed by intellectuals on the left? I'm CS. Gabriel Rockhill has written about the yellow vests movement, the violence deployed against it, and the French intelligentsia's opinions of it. He'll join me coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. They're called the Yellow Vests because they don the vests that people in France are required to carry in their cars in case of emergency. They took to the streets in the hundreds of thousands last November to protest a plan to raise fuel taxes, but their grievances have multiplied and their hostility toward Emmanuel Macron's administration has not abated. What do the Yellow Vests want? Are they pursuing reform or revolution or something else? What's been the response of the Macron regime and of the often high-profile French intelligentsia, many of whom are on the left? Gabriel Rockhill, a Villanova University philosophy professor, as well as director of the Critical Theory Workshop at the Sorbonne in Paris, has been writing about these issues. His article, "The Failure of the French Intelligentsia," with a question mark, "Intellectuals and Uprisings in the Case of the Yellow Vests," recently attracted my attention. Rockhill's most recent book is Counterhistory of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. When Gabriel Rockhill joined me recently via Skype from Philadelphia, I asked him when and how the Yellow Vests uprising began.
The movement, like most broad social movements, doesn't have a very clear beginning because there were a whole series of precursor signs and modes of organization. And in fact, in many ways, the Yellow Vests come out of a series of insurgencies that have been rocking France over the last few years, going back at least to the Nuit Debout movement, but then also including the student protests and worker protests just about a year and a half, 2 years ago. The standard date, though, that has been at least retroactively fixed for the Yellow Vests is November 17th, because it's at that point in time that the first general day of action was planned against the fuel tax that the Macron regime was going to impose. That date became important because then from that first Saturday day of action, since then, every Saturday in France, there's been a kind of targeted day of action. And we're now at 6 months of every weekend there being these types of actions. And so that's created a kind of consolidated centrality to the movement, if you will. But of course, there's been a whole series of other things that have been going on in parallel, meaning other forms of occupations, active strikes, flash blockades, and things like that, sometimes on the Saturday day of action, sometimes throughout the week. And there have also been general assemblies and modes of kind of collective education and community building that have been part of that. Now, regarding the concerns of the movement and what its preoccupations are, the fuel tax, many people have now identified, is just a tiny spark, but immediately it grew into a preoccupation with a set of larger concerns, mainly having to do with the financial and economic stranglehold of contemporary neoliberal capitalism over the middle and lower classes.
So in addition to the fuel tax, what are some of the consequences of neoliberalization in France that have affected people to the extent that they really feel so desperate that they need to go out in the streets?
There's a whole series of different dimensions to this. There's the, of course, not just the fuel tax, but then there's the retirement policy, the fact that Macron has then used his position of power in order to become the kind of governmental official of the rich and to give them certain tax breaks. There's a concern with the democratic modes of governance and the ways in which the general population doesn't really have access to power. And so as of December, one of the major claims on the part of the movement or desires on the part of the movement was to have a national kind of network of popular referenda so that the very modes of governance could be changed and that the concerns of the general population could be voiced. And so I think there's a combination of at least two factors. One is the kind of economic assault on the middle and lower classes that's been going on for years now, as well as the ways in which the standard representational framework available in France, meaning both the unions and the professional political parties, have not actually allocated power to the general population. And it's the conjoining of those two factors, along with some others, environmental concerns, feminist concerns, questions around immigration, et cetera, that has... Those are some of the central preoccupations of the movement. That being said, like any social movement, of course, there are forces that push and pull in different directions. And so there are also a number of activists who are directly anti-capitalist and identify capitalism as the core problem behind both the economic assault on the middle and lower classes and the pseudo-democratic functioning of the actual institutions, if they be the dominant unions or the dominant political parties.
What was the Macron administration's justification for the rise in the fuel tax, and how has that gone over with protesters?
It's the standard neoliberal justification, which is that there is an attempt to pass off some form of, invented green capitalism or something along these lines, in which the kind of economic imperatives that Macron is beholden to make him dress up what it is that he's doing in a way that you make the middle and lower classes pay for purported ecological changes. And so there's been a lot of debate around exactly what that means. But obviously, in the world that we live in, if we want to take seriously into account the ecological crisis, then we have to look at the core of the problem, and that is the capitalist mode of economic production. And instead of doing that, what the Macron government has done, like many other governments around the world, is you target the poor and the lower classes, the rural communities, and you somehow make them, you know, the responsible agents of ecological destruction, and then try to sell off the fuel tax as a way of reducing consumption. And so one of the other factors that I probably should have highlighted in the way in which the Yellow Vests emerged is that it's largely driven by a rural and suburban, but in the French sense of the term. So these are the semi-urban sprawl around the major cities in France that have been the driving forces. And a lot of those areas, there isn't public transportation and regular access to the forms of transportation that you get in a city like Paris, for instance. And so the fuel tax is also clearly directed towards certain sectors of the population that are really dependent on the automobile, given the current structures, you know, the current infrastructure that we have. And so that's also part of what the Macron regime has done. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of the Yellow Vests have accused Macron of being an elite who is part of this very centralized bureaucratic system of control, in which those who are in rural sectors or semi-urban sectors of France are targeted quite directly.
You've alluded, Gabriel, to various elements of the Yellow Vest movement, the rural and suburban folks, the anti-capitalist folks. There is a great diversity of people and ideas within the ranks of this movement. Is there any way to spell out, you know, without taking an hour, how many perspectives, ideological and otherwise, this movement encompasses?
It's very difficult to know. I mean, one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the activists have rejected traditional party alignments. And in that regard, they don't self-identify with a particular party or political leader. I do think that it's important that regardless of the ideological diversity, one of the unifying features is the ongoing capitalist assault on the middle and lower classes, and that's one of the reasons that I've argued in this article and some of the others that I shared, with you that this is a form of contemporary class warfare, and that in class warfare, there's often a mixing of all forms of ideological alignment from the extreme left to the extreme right. And one of the reasons for that is that even though the root causes might be readily identifiable, the solutions in relationship to those root causes often leads to some ideological misalignment or some ideological orientations that are often very much opposed. I think as the movement has evolved over time, there has been a backing away from some of the ways in which the movement was maligned at its very beginning, particularly through the mass media and the Macron regime, was identifying it as fascist and extreme right wing, etc. It's very clear at this point in time that the center of gravity of the movement is working class people who are looking for a better life than the life that is currently available to them through the economic and political system that's been established in France.
That's Gabriel Rockhill. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University. We're discussing a number of things he's written recently. We're starting with a piece he wrote that appeared on the Philosophical Salon website. It's called The Failure of the French Intelligentsia, Intellectuals and Uprisings in the Case of the Yellow Vests. And yes, Gabriel, a lot of ink has been spilled about the Yellow Vest movement and who they are, what they represent, what their agenda is, do they have demands, what the response of the government is. You have chosen in this piece, and this is not your sole focus in relation to this movement, but you have chosen in this piece to focus on the response of the intelligentsia and the left-wing intelligentsia in France to the Yellow Vests. What made you want to investigate this issue?
Well, originally it was just because I was following the movement very closely, and I was dismayed by the way in which the most prominent voices in the French intelligentsia either remained silent on the issue or came out opposed to it in various ways. And as I'm sure you and your listeners know, the French intelligentsia has, at least since the 1960s, had a certain reputation of being left-wing. At least the most visible aspects of the French intelligentsia, particularly the kind of self-proclaimed torchbearers of May 68. And it's precisely some of those intellectuals who were either silent on the movement or came out with quite overt criticisms of it. And so after following those developments for quite some time, I decided to expand my analysis to look at the kind of broader question of how intellectuals historically have related to radical social movements that are diverse, multiform, that don't necessarily have one single ideological agenda, and raise the large question of how are intellectuals generally conditioned to react to broad social movements, and what are ways in which they can contribute to those social movements. And this is, of course, in juxtaposition to some of the prominent French intellectuals whom I identify in the piece, who generally prefer to remain on the sidelines and bemoan the fact that the people have not followed their own self-proclaimed idea of what a radical social movement or a revolutionary movement should look like.
And kind of implicit in your critique is that intellectuals in France and elsewhere, thinkers, professional thinkers, academics, that they exert a kind of influence on society, that what they say and what they do in relation to, for example, radical movements really matters. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it depends on the precise institutional framework that we're discussing, but in the case of France, it's very clear that intellectuals occupy an important public position, and they're regularly invited on radio and TV and in the newspapers and whatnot, and they're taken as kind of touchstones for how we should understand contemporary society. And the fact that certain intellectuals would come out against particular movements does carry a certain amount of weight because of the role that they play, but also the symbolic capital that they have within the punditocracy. And in that regard, if you have, for instance, one of the examples that I point out in the piece that I wrote is the case of Alain Badiou, who's probably, arguably one of the most famous living French intellectuals who is constantly on TV, on the radio, writing for the newspaper, etc., in France. And he remained silent on the movement for months and then came out in March and published a very, very critical piece of the entire movement, saying that there was nothing in it that he found of any political interest whatsoever. That does carry a certain amount of weight. Of course, it doesn't carry weight for all people involved. A lot of, I think, the activists on the ground would simply roll their eyes and consider him to be part of the elite technocracy that they themselves are opposed to, right? But I think it does consolidate and allow for the consolidation of certain media narratives and certain modes of explanation, as well as corral certain sectors of the managerial classes into supporting or not supporting a particular movement.
Now, many of these thinkers work at universities and other educational institutions. They're embedded in these institutions. What do you want to say about how the context in which they operate affects the way that they affects their role? They're, in some sense, I think you call it the socioeconomic role in society.
Yeah, I think that there's an unfortunate image of institutions of higher education as being somehow ivory towers that are disconnected from the social, political, and economic world, and they afford the experience of a kind of intellectual bubble in which one can pursue ideas for their own sake, etc. But for anyone who has actually studied the material history of universities and institutions of higher education, we know that those institutions play very specific economic and political roles. And one of those roles, at least in the contemporary world, is to reproduce the social relations of production. So to operate a kind of social triage so that those who don't go to the university go into the, you know, manual labor, those who are educated to a certain extent within the kind of vocational framework are then allocated to a different sector of work, and those who pursue studies that go to the highest possible level will then become members of the managerial classes, etc. And that structural role is at once political and economic. And that the intellectuals who are teaching in those institutions, what their social function is, and I say this very clearly in the article, because it's, I think, regardless whether or not they recognize this or they would admit it themselves, their social function is one of reproducing, under the political and economic system of capitalism, the dominant relations of power. And the question then for me becomes one of not, should an intellectual be committed to a particular cause? What should that cause be, etc.? But rather, what do we do about the fact that any professional intellectual, meaning an intellectual who's working in these types of institutions, is always already instrumentalized by a political and economic system? And what do they do in relationship to that instrumentalization? Because if you don't do anything in relationship to that instrumentalization, then you simply fulfill your role of reproducing the very system of exploitation and oppression, which is that of global capitalism, which is, of course, the dominant system today. One of the reasons that I think that that is important is because it foregrounds how politics is constitutive of the life of the professional intellectual. It's not somehow a supplement or something secondary or something that one could choose to engage with. It's the very starting point of the social role that one plays within a system of power.
So then I take it does not surprise you when intellectuals either ignore movements or speak out against movements that oppose the dominant socioeconomic order?
No, in fact, that's their social role. There are, of course, and that's one of the reasons that it's interesting in the case of the intellectuals that I point out in the case of France, there are class traitors and intellectual renegades, and there are, you know, thousands of examples that we could point to in this regard, and those are people who have pursued higher education, might potentially be working within institutions of higher learning, but at the same time, they have an analysis of the material relations of power that allows them to be critical both of that system and of the way in which that system relates to radical social movements. And so in that regard, they're are intellectuals who not only, and it's what I refer to in the piece, is the difference between an instrumentalized intellectual who just plays their kind of pre-chosen or preordained social and economic function versus an interventionist intellectual. And an interventionist intellectual attempts to break with the way in which they've been socialized or should have been socialized if they succeeded within a particular system, and instead dedicate themselves to at once materially understanding how that system works and then also identifying how that system can be transformed in various ways.
Alain Badiou, you mentioned earlier, certainly one of the most prominent public intellectuals in France, as you said. Tell us more. So you write, and you just said that he says that these folks on the streets, they lack ideas, they lack a vision, they're ignorant. What do you make of this critique, and how accurate is it?
Well, I think there's a tendency on the part of the professional intelligentsia to at once presume that a movement is unified around a particular subjectivity or a particular position, instead of actually trying to study and learn from the movement and look at its complexities. And so the idea that the movement wouldn't have any ideas, or that the protesters, as Zizek says, for instance, don't really know what they want.
Slavoj Zizek, uh-huh.
Yeah, this type of approach is very much a perspective from the sidelines that presumes that the all-knowing intellectual master has the right ideas and knows exactly how history should unfold, and that the unruly horde is ignorant and misguided. And this type of intellectual posturing, I think, it's really integral to the standard habitus or the kind of acquired dispositions of professional intellectuals, because that's what they're trained to think about themselves, that their ideas somehow matter more and that they have a greater grasp of how the world actually works, and that the kind of hoi polloi or the general public doesn't have the level of refinement that they have. And one of the things that I find in this kind of anti-populist orientation is that it's almost as if, you know, the people as certain kind of high priests of metaphysical Marxism, and that's how I qualify the work of Slavoj Žižek and Alain Badiou, the people are acceptable as long as they're doing what their theories presume that they should do. But as soon as the people really start to exercise agency and express ideas that might be ideas that are different than theirs, or undertake actions that aren't in accord with the actions that they would outline, all of a sudden they then kind of fall off the spectrum and need to be denigrated and chastised and put back in their place. The last thing that I would say in that regard is that I'm also not arguing that then all intellectuals should just blindly support a movement and be absolutely for it. In fact, I don't think that that type of orientation of either being for or against a major social movement makes sense, because a movement is constituted out of a whole series of different dimensions and aspects and people pushing and pulling in different directions. And so the core of my argument is that intellectuals should get involved in that push and pull rather than staying on the sidelines and simply proclaiming themselves to be for or against a movement as if a movement were a singular thing and as if history was frozen and you just had to decide what side you were on, instead of history being a moving train, and us needing to not be neutral on that moving train, because we have to recognize that the consequences of that movement largely depend on who gets involved and how they get involved.
Gabriel Rockhill is his name. He teaches philosophy at Villanova University. He directs the Critical Theory Workshop at the Sorbonne. And we'll take a short break and return and speak more with Gabriel about the Yellow Vest movement in France and the reaction of French thinkers to it. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joining me from Philadelphia is Gabriel Rockhill. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University, and he is author of books like Interventions in Contemporary Thought, History, Politics, Aesthetics, and Counter History of the Present. And we are talking about his writings about the Yellow Vests movement in France and the reaction to it by government authorities and by the intelligentsia in that nation. Jacques Rancière, another very prominent, world-famous French intellectual, he, you write, lumps the Yellow Vests together with other movements based on the occupation of public squares and spaces. Is that an accurate assessment?
His assessment, like the assessment put forth by Alain Badiou, is just materially incorrect in the sense that the Yellow Vest movement has not been aligned on one of the now standard tactics that is affiliated with the public square movements, anything from Tahrir Square to the Occupy movement to Gezi Park in Turkey and other such locations. One of the things that I think is actually quite unique about the Yellow Vests is the decision to break with that model of occupation, which is, of course, extremely difficult to maintain over time, requires ample resources, and there are important things that come out of the occupation of public squares. But the Yellow Vests decided instead to focus on targeted days of action. That is, not occupying a public square, but once a week, having targeted days of action across France that bring people together in various ways, and to link those program days of action to one another over time. And it's been an important tactic because it has allowed the movement to survive not only the massive police assault on the part of the Macron regime against the Yellow Vests, but also the winter, which has often led in the past to the depletion of certain forms of public protest. And so in that regard, when Rancière and Badiou claim that the Yellow Vest movement is just part of this recent square movement, I think what they miss is the important new tactic. I mean, it's not a new tactic because people have used it in the past, but in relationship to the square movements, a very significant tactical shift that we can also learn a lot from in developing actions in the future.
What about this issue of violence? We've been hearing a lot from the Macron government about how violent the Yellow Vest protesters are. Étienne Balibar, another French intellectual, he has voiced his disdain for insurrectional violence. Is this a fair criticism of the Yellow Vests, that they have engaged in violence that is unjustified?
I think that any time that we discuss the question of violence and social movements, we have to be very vigilant regarding the ideological function of the term violence. And the reason that I say that is because the status quo is often defined within the mass media, and the professional intelligentsia often does this as well, as somehow being nonviolent. But the starting point for any analysis of violence should be a material analysis of the current status quo of global capitalism. And this is clearly an extremely violent, exploitative, and oppressive system that has had far-reaching consequences for the destruction of the lives of most people around the world most of the time. In relationship to that, the way the mass media and a lot of the professional intelligentsia identifies something called violence, and I put this in quotes, is anything that would interrupt the systematic modes of oppression and exploitation integral to the capitalist system. Now, calling that, these intermittent forms, violent, and not recognizing the systemic violence of the system itself is actually, it's almost a perfect example of Marx's camera obscura. It's turning the world upside down. The real purveyor of violence is the state-sanctioned and state-imposed forms of capitalism under the Macron regime, for instance. And the very intermittent property damage that we see blown up in the mass media is an attempt to denigrate the movement, label it as violent, criminalize it, and thereby align public opinion against it. And in the case of the Macron regime and the mass media in France, we've seen this very clearly in a number of revealing instances, including a whole series of eyewitness accounts in which the police have allowed certain forms of property damage to occur, have potentially at least instigated them or done them themselves. There's a whole series of photographs of the police either breaking windows or carrying hammers around or things like this, precisely in order to create the spectacle of violence, the violence of the protesters, in order to distract from the real structural violence, which is what the protesters are opposed to. And that's the structural violence of mass poverty and exploitation.
What about simply an accounting of the number of people injured by yellow vest protesters versus the number of protesters who've been injured because of tear gas and other grenades and other police violence?
Yeah, in the case of the number of protesters who have been injured, it's been really, I think, without precedent. Both the injuries, and at least within France, both the injuries and the number of those who have been arrested and had charges pressed against them. The exact figures are very hard to calculate, constantly changing. And of course, the state is not doing a very good job at maintaining those statistics. But we do know that liberal institutions like the United Nations, the European Council, and Amnesty International have identified these abuses very clearly. And in fact, the Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights, I mean, she prepared a memorandum in February that identified the number of LBD rounds that have been used against the protesters. And this was in February. There's already 12,000 rounds that had been used.
LBD?
1,500. LBD are the, they're like grenades that are shot mm-hmm. in order to disperse the general population. Uh-huh. In French, it's the lanceur de balles. So it's like a grenade launcher, basically. One of the concerns in France has been with the militarization of the police and the way in which they've been using military-grade arms in order to attack the general population.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gabriel Rockhill joins me, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University and Director of the Critical Theory Workshop at the Sorbonne. As you said earlier, not all French intellectuals have taken stands in relation to the yellow vest that you disapprove of. There is a scholar named Sophie Vaniche, and she's drawn on the research she's done into the French Revolution and analyzed the uprisings in France in that context. What has she said that you find encouraging?
Well, I think it's interesting because she's looked into the ways in which one of the factors operative within the French Revolution was an uprising amongst the kind of working classes and the rural classes that was not just consolidated around singular ideologies, but was driven by, you know, modalities of class warfare. And identifying how what's happening now has certain echoes from the past, but is also trying to continue particular traditions, because she's pointed out a lot of the symbols actually that have been used by the yellow vests are recuperating some of the symbols from the French Revolution, the Paris Commune, other kind of high moments of revolutionary activism in the history of France. And so there's a very conscious attempt on the part of certain activists involved with the yellow vests to identify what it is that they're doing with a deeper revolutionary tradition in France. And Sophie Vaniche actually has a book that will be coming out, I think, in the fall, in which she develops this argument in greater detail.
And so we have a lot of intellectuals who are historians of social movements, progressive movements, radical movements. I mean, do you see this as one way in which intellectuals can really help social movements, can supplement their knowledge or knowledges with the expertise of deep thinkers?
I do think that studying the material history of social movements, understanding how they have operated in the past, and also identifying the kind of complex set of agencies that's operative in any revolutionary conjuncture is extremely important and constitutes a kind of ongoing body of knowledge. I don't think that we have a blueprint for how radical social transformation operates. So we can learn from the past, but I don't think that we can cull from the past something like, you know, the model for how all future activities should operate. In fact, one of the fascinating things about revolutionary history is that it's often pushed forward by certain actors who are not following preordained models or established blueprints in various ways. But we can nonetheless learn from and try to move forward in various ways. I do think that intellectuals can play a number of other roles, though, and one of the very important ones is just to get involved in movements themselves and to become part of a kind of collective ethos of transformation, rather than presuming that one can only speak of a movement in the third person as it being something that somebody else does and that you as an intellectual would judge or look at from the outside. I also think that the study of techniques and strategies is extremely important. Kind of what we were talking about earlier with the targeted days of action as opposed to occupations, this is important to both conceptualize and theorize and related to other struggles in order to develop the kind of collective knowledge and the toolbox that is so necessary for movements as they develop. And consolidating that toolbox conceptual, I think, is important. It's one of the things that with the Radical Education Department, which is one of the political organizations that I'm part of, has tried to do. Very early on, we published an article called 10 Lessons from the Yellow Vests, where we really just tried to learn from the movement and identify what its fundamental contributions, its most positive contributions to date have been, so that we could kind of conceptualize it in its process, learn from it, but then in learning from it, also bring those tools together so they can be used in future actions in different contexts, etc.
Yeah, that article, 10 Lessons from the Yellow Vests, which first appeared in the online resource It's Going Down, it brings up the citizen-initiated referendum. What is that, and to what extent are the Yellow Vests in France pushing for it?
It became, at the end of 2018, the beginning of 2019, one of the central focal points. The idea is that there could be a system that would be set up by which the general population could call a referendum on really any topic that it would want, and then proceed via the referendum, so via a vote, to either abrogate certain laws, sign into law, other measures. The idea is to try to displace political power away from the elected officials of a pseudo-democracy and put it more in the hands of the general population. There are, of course, you know, certain limitations to that kind of orientation and modality insofar as it would still maintain the overall system of governance that is in place in France, so the elite technocracy, and kind of supplement it with something else. But it's an interesting way of thinking about how we actually have the technological capabilities to do such things, and it would be quite easy. We don't have to wait 4 or 5 years for an election. We could have publicly initiated referenda in France. We could do the same thing in the United States, and get the people to express what it is that they want on a regular basis and have that be the basis for a modality of governance. So I still think it's quite an interesting, potentially kind of transitional modality of governance that should be explored.
This piece, 10 Lessons from the Yellow Vests, again, penned by the Radical Education Department, an autonomous collective of which Gabriel is a part, also forwards the idea of seizing important sites of power like the Sorbonne, a major TV channel, or the Jeu de Paume Museum. Talk about that.
Well, this was written at a point in time at which the movement was still going through a kind of process of escalation. And I think that one of the important things that intellectuals, including the organic intellectuals of social movements, can do is to identify where movements can move, like what the next steps could potentially be. This is, of course, related to our earlier exchange regarding all the things that we can learn from past social movements. And I do think that seizing sites of power and or orchestrating certain forms of blockades, for instance, can be a way of escalating the struggles. In fact, one of the things that I'm very interested in seeing in the coming weeks is the ways in which I think there will be some shifts in the tactics of the Yellow Vests to date. They've survived 6 months of a brutal assault on the part of the Macron regime. And the Macron regime has really made little or no concessions. I mean, just tiny, tiny fragments of concessions. And so there's been a lot of talk amongst the organizers of the Yellow Vests about shifting tactics, escalating the modes of confrontation, et cetera. So I think that in the coming weeks, particularly with the fact that the Yellow Vests have made it through the winter and that we have the kind of ensuing summer months, we're going to see these types of, you know, perhaps not these tactics precisely, but parallel tactics emerging in various ways.
My guest is Gabriel Rockhill. He teaches philosophy at Villanova University. And we've put a link on our website, againstthegrain.org, to Gabriel's website, where you can read about him and about his many publications and interventions. We are taping this interview several days before the air date. Where do the movement protesters stand? How many people are coming out? How can we assess kind of the energy and the level of participation of the Yellow Vests right now?
It's difficult to know what the exact numbers are, in part because the mass media in the state is constantly downplaying them and suggesting that the movement has burnt out, that there's nobody left in the streets, etc. There's been a little bit of fluctuations, but we do know that there are tens of thousands of people who are participating in the orchestrated days of action every Saturday, and that these are coupled with ongoing occupations of roundabouts around France, general assemblies, forms of local kind of political organizing and education, etc. And so there's no real sign that the movement has flagged in any really significant way as of late. It will be interesting to see, though, in the coming weeks, whether or not there can be a kind of rejuvenation. I think that in the history of social movements, there are sometimes times at which there are particular patterns that become established and things become a bit more rote, and then people will break out of the kind of established set of relations between, for instance, protesters and the police, or where exactly actions are occurring, etc. And the creativity of the Yellow Vests has been quite extraordinary. There's been a whole series of inventions of new tactics over time. And so I have the sense, of course, no one can predict the future, but I have the sense that in the coming weeks, we'll see new and creative tactics that we haven't yet seen thus far.
So as we sum up, Gabriel, what are specific ways in which you think, and you've begun to talk about this already, but ways in which intellectuals can contribute to the maintenance of social movements, but their radicalization?
Yeah, I think there are a few different ways that can be done, and I don't think that there's a set program that everyone could potentially follow, but given the fact that professional intellectuals have a particular public platform, they can use that in order to identify the ways in which social movements have been denigrated by the mass media or by professional politicians, and kind of chart out what the kind of ideological trappings are that often ensnare movements in particular ways. But they can also, through their direct involvement with the movements and their knowledge of the kind of deep history of radical social struggle, begin to, you know, propose ways of either radicalizing the movement or identifying the kind of root causes that are a preoccupation in order to undertake a kind of systemic critique, because ultimately that's what radical critique would be one that really goes to the root and identifies the systemic problem. In the case of the yellow vest, to be more explicit, the reason that there are so many middle class and lower middle class and poor people who are having trouble just meeting the basic requirements to continue and survive is that there's a system of economic and political exploitation that is hellbent on maximizing profit at the expense of people. And if we identify that as the problem, and not just a few fat cats or a few taxes that would be imposed by the Macron regime, then we can move things to a much more radical and systemic critique that is a critique of capitalism, and identify Macron and his regime and the elite technocracy as a symptom of a much, much larger system. And I do think that intellectuals, or professional intellectuals who've been trained in the history of traditions like Marxism and anarchism and various anti-colonial struggles, radical feminist struggles, etc., have the tools to do this broader totality critique and the systemic analysis, which is integral to moving movements from kind of just a set of demands or to requesting that a government act in particular ways to an escalation that really identifies the core of the problems that are operative and charts out paths by which one could begin to address those core problems and those core issues.
Is it your sense that at least some French thinkers and probably thinkers around the world that in looking at the yellow vest, they critique it because they somehow want the system overturned all at once in a very consistent, predictable manner, and that is not happening, and that is why they think the yellow vests are too anarchic or too dispersed or scattered in their program to support it?
I think that's a very good assessment, in the sense that at least those leftist intellectuals, largely Marxist intellectuals, who do identify capitalism as the core problem that is behind the yellow vest protests, often rely on a kind of either implicit or explicit messianic conception of revolution, in which one would move from point A, capitalist system, for instance, to point Z, which would be some form of communism, more or less overnight or magically or very quickly, and not recognize that politics is always a sloppy and complicated process in which there's a multiplicity of agencies, there are counter-revolutionary forces, and that nothing really follows this magical pattern of transformation, because to get from point A to point Z, you have to move through the entire alphabet. And if you take a few baby steps to B and C and D, and that means galvanizing people around common causes, identifying common enemies, beginning to agitate and educate and organize, these can be very important parts of a larger process. And you can't get to that larger process unless you go through these smaller parts.
Well, I can imagine some scholars listening to this program and your words saying, okay, Gabriel, you want us to get involved in social movements, not just to assess them from the outside, from a distance. But what might that do, a scholar might think, to my objectivity, to my ability to look at this in a kind of objective way? Because then, you know, if I get involved, my hopes and aspirations get tied up with it, and I can't have that kind of detachment that would make me assess it in a more, and again, this word objectivity comes up quite a bit, in a more objective way.
I would say that all intellectuals are already part of movements, and that the socioeconomic standing of the professional intellectual is inserted within the movement of modern capitalism. And the creation of the illusion of objectivity is the result of those intellectuals simply not recognizing the fact that their socioeconomic standing is part of the perpetuation of the movement and the system of which they're a part, again, which is capitalism. So for me, the question is not one of maintaining one's objectivity by keeping a distance from movements, but rather by recognizing that all objectivities are constructed out of social worlds, and that the objectivity of the purported professional intellectual is one that's constructed out of systems of higher education and an apparatus of knowledge that is fundamentally capitalist, and that getting involved in alternative social movements would actually be an increase in quote-unquote objectivity, or at least the ability to recognize that there's not just one world, the world of capitalism and its knowledge apparatus, but there are other worlds that can potentially be constructed and that are already being constructed, and so that there'd actually be an increase in a sense of objectivity understood as the capacious understanding of everything that's possible within, within the world, and that can largely result from getting involved in and understanding movements from the inside. In that regard, I think that it's not just that objectivity or intellectual objectivity is an illusion produced by the dominant apparatus of knowledge, but that we can, through materialist engagement in actual struggles, increase our kind of knowledge of the world by breaking with the assumption that somehow we would have better knowledge if we remain detached from it.
Gabriel Rockhill is his name, associate professor of philosophy at Villanova University. His most recent book is Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. And we've put a link on againstthegrain.org to three pieces that he wrote or contributed to. His article, The Failure of the French Intelligentsia with a Question Mark, appeared on the Philosophical Salon website. His article, Spectacular Violence as a Weapon of War Against the Yellow Vests, appeared on the Counterpunch website in March. And he contributed to a piece called 10 Lessons from the Yellow Vests. Gabriel, thank you so much for your work and for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.